You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Ai Weiwei, the Chinese artist, has made several documentaries about human rights abuses and injustices in China, but never has a documentary been made about him until now. Ai Weiwei, Never Sorry, reveals how last year's Time magazine Man of the Year runner-up went from being the architect of the Beijing Olympic bird nest to spending 81 days in detention because of his activist art. Alison Clayman's film, which won the 2012 Sundance Jury Prize, opens today at the IFC Center and the Lincoln Plaza Cinemas, and very pleased to welcome her to our show. Hello.
So great to be here. Thank you.
When did you first hear about Ai Weiwei? When did you meet him for the first time?
In my case, it's sort of a special case where all of that is wrapped up in like the same story. So I went to China after I graduated from college, not because I had any background in China or I had studied it, but because I wanted to become a journalist, a radio journalist, and maybe do documentary film. And I ended up going to China with a friend, and I didn't know who Ai Weiwei was. And you kind of fast forward 2 years later, and I was sort of speaking Mandarin and about to have a journalist accreditation and had been working there for a couple of years. And my roommate at the time was curating an exhibition of his for a local gallery in Beijing. And she told me about him, and I got to look at these works in my house. And
there were photographs of New York.
Exactly.
And ironically.
So what's funny, too, is that that was a period of his life that was previously, it was relatively unexamined until these photographs were put together in this show. And they have since traveled the world to New York and Berlin and so many places. But for me, that was actually the first thing that I really got to know about Ai Weiwei, because my roommate would bring home the contact sheets. Like, he took over 10,000 photographs while he lived in New York from 83 to 93. And you see all the Chinese cultural figures sort of living their bohemian lifestyle, making art, you know, drinking wine at the laundromat. And you also see, you know, Tompkins Square Park riots and, you know, ACT UP protests. It was just an amazing body of work and really gritty. And so, you know, so there was so much there. So it really captured my imagination. And I learned a little bit about him by looking him up and through what my roommate said. And towards the end of 2008, she asked if I wanted to help out and make a video to accompany the exhibition. And that was both how I heard about Weiwei, got to meet him, and the reason why day one I was already there with a camera.
And that led to a short documentary that was shown on PBS's Frontline series,
yeah,
some of which you've incorporated into this larger film.
Yeah, well, actually, that was sort of 2 years later when I was headed back to New York to begin editing Never Sorry. PBS contacted me and said they'd heard about my project and they wondered if I wanted to do a little piece to kind of introduce him. I think they heard about it from Evan Osnos, because he's done stuff for PBS Frontline as well, and he's the New Yorker correspondent, and he's also in Never Sorry.
So was this a challenging story for you to tell as a first-time filmmaker and someone who was still a foreigner in China, even if you'd lived there for a while?
I mean, I think at the outset, you know, I approached this with a really, really open attitude. You know, clearly I sort of had the opportunity to meet him, and it was really the force of his personality and obviously all the things about him that are kind of provocative and seem to be leading to, you know, to see parts of China, you know, and aspects of China that I really hadn't encountered, even though I'd already been living there for 2 years. And so, you know, in following him, I think the whole time I was just really committed to this idea that it was going to be the best, most in-depth look, you know, really intimate look at Ai Weiwei. But I had no idea, you know, at the outset, I didn't say this is a movie about human rights or this is a freedom of expression. I mean, I was just like, this is about this guy that I really want to know more.
Well, you couldn't have known that the circumstances were going to develop the way they did. But did you know that you were a natural filmmaker? The Times Review today called your film galvanizing, stark, beautiful, haunting, not bad.
Yeah, I mean, I was incredibly humbled and blown away when I saw that yesterday. And as you can imagine, I was like sitting nervous, waiting to see what they would say. It's the kind of thing where I don't like to pretend that there was any more intention on my part than I had. But when I do look back, I see that this has been a dream of mine for a really long time.
Did you have to get permission from the Chinese authorities to shoot? Because you went with Ai Weiwei wherever he traveled.
I always looked at it as an extension of my work as a journalist. And as an accredited journalist, which literally I got my press accreditation during the like first or second week I was spending with Ai Weiwei. I had been going through the process and I showed him my press card. And with that, I have the legal right right to be filming anyone who's accepting an interview with me, whether it's, you know, in public or private. So I always looked at that as an extension of my work. And I think documentary isn't quite the same as a movie where you might need to get a permit to be doing a shoot or something like that.
And he was perfectly happy to give you total access to him?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely something that's often remarked on, you know, for the film in terms of how much it seems like there's so much access. And if you think about it, this is a guy who is, an advocate of transparency, who sort of lives his life as a model of transparency, puts so much online. So on the one hand, it kind of makes perfect sense that I did have all this access and he was so comfortable with a camera around because he had already put himself, you know, in front of the lens for many, many years. I think what was different was, you know, first of all, I was an independent kind of look at him and also, you know, a more longitudinal one. I mean, I was set to kind of do this for a while. But I do think that, you know, for me, it meant that the challenge was to find those quiet moments and the moments when nobody else was, you know, there to film and kind of trying to push the boundaries of what he would like to reveal.
Is it ironic that this film is opening on the eve of the Olympics? Because you started filming in December 2008, right after Ai Weiwei went from being China's darling for constructing the Olympic Stadium to being seen as an enemy for denouncing it as a political propaganda. He actually was critical of the Olympics.
Absolutely. I mean, that sort of Olympic moment is where I sort of start the timeline for Ai Weiwei as this, you know, international figure in the news section, you know, on the front page of the news section and not just the art section. That's the moment when, you know, he helped with the design of the bird's nest, which, by the way, he was not invited to do. They entered an open competition, and he was sort of consulting with the Swiss architects Herzog and Dameron.
But they were proud of the fact that a Chinese artist had done this thing that had gotten so much acclaim.
I honestly don't know, because, you know, if you ask people in China who designed the bird's nest, they'll say, oh, it was those two European architects, right? I mean, it's around the rest of the world where we know, oh, it was Ai Weiwei. You know, sometimes people shorthand it and say Ai Weiwei did it, which is also kind of not true. He was a consultant. He was the Chinese side of this team. I mean, I think to me that's the perfect example, and I didn't know this until a lot of years with him in research and kind of coming to this conclusion, but that's the perfect example of why what Ai Weiwei is doing right now is not for his own sort of fame or benefit, because he had the perfect road set up for him in order to be a famous, rich, you know, Chinese artist and architect if he had been embraced by the government. He, you know, that road
but
was open to
didn't
him.
Didn't the government build a large studio for him? I mean, later they tore it down.
Around that same time, a local mayor in Shanghai who wanted to have an art district in his area approached Weiwei and asked him to do that. And Weiwei said no for a really long time. So he said he was done with government projects. But the mayor came up to Beijing, and he was so earnest about it that Weiwei agreed. As soon as it was finished, it was also demolished, which is also kind of hard to explain why that would happen. But that was more of a localized kind of thing, the way I looked at it.
It's interesting. It was government construction. Then they said it was poorly constructed.
Well, they said he didn't have the permits. And he said when he first got that notice, he ignored it because he thought, well, you guys invited me. Clearly the permit should have been taken care of.
Alison Clayman is my guest. She's the director of Ai Weiwei, Never Sorry, which opens today at the Lincoln Plaza Cinema and the IFC Center. Among Ai Weiwei's most provocative works was his Sichuan Earthquake Names project, for which he compiled the first thorough record of the victims of the earthquake. Did you follow him to Sichuan?
In the end, the footage in Sichuan from that investigation is all from his own projects and from his volunteers. I followed him back later after he was already battling sort of various government actions against him.
And then he also went after the police in 2009. He made a documentary called Lao Ma Tihua, Disturbing the Peace, revisiting the Chengdu police that had beaten him to keep him from testifying at the trial of another activist. What was your impression of how the Chinese police conducted themselves? What does it say about the rule of law in China?
Well, I think there's like a couple different levels. There's the police who are sort of the uniform police that seem like, you see them in the film, they just kind of seem like, you know, hapless, you know, parts of the system. They're just doing their job. They need to report to the guy above them. They don't have any particular reason to think that Ai Weiwei is a criminal or to kind of take action against him. And I think you can see the compassion that Weiwei has for them and kind of the way that he relates to them as a person and trying to encourage them to think as individuals. Then there are the plainclothes cops. There's the sort of public security officers that don't have a badge, and you're not going to find out what their number is or what their name is. And they seem a lot more like the hooligans that kind of one of the interviewees in the film talks about.
But is there a sense that because he has such an international reputation, he was named the leading artist in the world, I think, by Art Review, the highest ranking living artist in the world, does that, do you think, affect the way the Chinese government deals with him and relates to him?
Well, I think the people who encounter him on the street don't necessarily know who he is at all. So that doesn't really have an impact. And certainly the young cop who hit him on the head had no idea who he was. I think that it does play some role. I mean, as we saw last year with his detention, the fact that he was released 81 days later, I mean, and he hasn't received as harsh a treatment as many, many other dissidents have.
He's still being charged with tax evasion for $2.4 million. Could he have ever made enough money to have run up such a tax bill?
I have no idea. And, you know, I think all of us are open to the evidence if someone was going to show it to us. But I think because of the way all this system works, it's pretty clear that that's really irrelevant.
How do you think the art world takes him as an artist? I mean, he goes from doing a heavy investigative piece on the earthquake to putting 10 million porcelain sunflower seeds in the Tate Modern. What does he say about? Oh, then he does a series of flipping the bird photographs, which almost Dadaist in spirit. Do you think they all fit into an aesthetic?
I definitely think they do, but that was one of the questions that I sort of was wondering about. To me, it's all about communication. That's what his work is kind of all about. And he's very fluent in a whole bunch of sort of highbrow and lowbrow methods of communication. And I think that he's also fluent in he's sort of a multimedia artist. He's a conceptual artist. He's an installation artist.
But he says there's no such thing as art. Mm. All art is politics.
Well, that sounds like a good concept to me. That sounds like another way that he's trying to communicate. I mean, I don't know. Those flipping the bird photos are at MoMA. You know what I mean? I think also photographs are easier for museums to collect when it comes to Chinese art. I think that the idea of all this work, what I think he's been doing in the last few years is also trying to reach people outside of the art world. I think he's really interested in having his message not just confined to the inside of a museum, even though it's not that he is sort of distancing himself from that as well. I think he's always had a dream of being, you know, a world-renowned artist. And so it's not that he's saying, you know, screw the museums. I think he just wants to say that's not the end. That's not the only place where I'm going to try to express myself.
Well, now he's expressing himself largely through the social media,
yes,
through blogging and tweeting.
Yes, and, you know, that was something that was sort of the stage had been set when I first met him in 2008. He had this incredibly popular blog, which was able to be viewed within the firewall, which meant that he was reaching the mainstream Chinese audiences directly with his words and his photos every day. And it was kind of remarkable to see that. Of course, 6 months later, when he published the names of the children who died in the Sichuan earthquake, that blog was shut down and surveillance cameras were put on his door. And that was one of the things I really wanted to show people. I think when you imagine an artist who's outspoken, you imagine he was born like with cameras on his door and with, you know, every turn his blog shut down, you know, every turn he's sort of silenced. But the truth is he's accomplished a lot and he has been able to accomplish a lot. What we've seen in the last few years is really this escalation of tightening.
Does Ai Weiwei ever fear becoming famous for the wrong reasons, for his arrest more than for his art?
I mean, I don't know if I've asked him that directly, so my answer would only be speculation, but I don't think he would want to be famous for that. I very much see him, and this is how I saw the film. It's not a story about censorship and being silenced. I think his story is the opposite. It's a story about using your voice and about what you can accomplish and how you find a way to maneuver. So I don't think he'd want to be defined by the things he can't do.
Well, we keep on hearing that China is in the process of democratizing, that I had some reporters on the show recently who said, well, a lot of stories get told. What's your sense? You lived in China for 4 years. Is it your sense that some things are allowed, other things are not? Someone like Ai Weiwei can never be sure what they're going to be upset about and what's going to be okay?
Well, that's what I thought the movie was about as I was shooting it for all those years, and I think it is still about. It's about the diversity of opinion in China and how people are finding ways through technology but also through their own individual kind of courage to take that step and to speak out, and that there has been a lot of room to kind of make those changes. The problem is, unfortunately, even since I shot this film, there has been a lot of tightening. You know, the situation right now is actually worse than those years, which I did not expect. But also, I just think that both things can be true. China has changed in a lot of ways, and nobody would deny that. But I don't think anybody would really disagree with the idea that there isn't freedom of expression, that there isn't total rule of law. I mean, I think people don't really disagree with Ai Weiwei. They just want to say, well, we're not ready for that yet. Or, Ai Weiwei, you're not acknowledging all the other ways that China's changed, But nobody would say that what he's talking about is actually untrue.
So what's his situation now? Is he under something akin to house arrest?
Well, I used to call it sort of Beijing arrest. I'm not sure what the status is now that we're past this year of bail conditions in terms of whether he can leave Beijing itself, but they have not returned his passport back, and they told him they don't want him to travel because he's still under various investigations, which is really disappointing because we thought the passport was maybe going to be returned if they had kept their word on June 22nd.
The title is refers to a title he gave to one of his shows.
Exactly. The biggest show of his life was in Munich in 2009. That was the biggest show up to that point, and it was called So Sorry. And his explanation for that title was the sort of emptiness of that kind of gesture and those kinds of words. And people say, oh, I'm so sorry, and they're not really sorry. So we kind of riffed off
that. That was
after
the Sichuan earthquake.
Yes, exactly. Or even, and any number of sort of things. Oh, stop following me. Stop surveilling me. Stop taking my articles down on my blog. Oh, so sorry.
Ai Weiwei, Never Sorry opens today at the IFC Center and the Lincoln Plaza Cinemas. Thank you so much, Allison Clemon, for being on our show.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.